From the home of the Codebreakers and the birthplace of modern computing, this is the Bletchley Park podcast.
Welcome to this additional episode of the Bletchley Park podcast, Oral History Special number 4. In our last Oral History Special, we brought you the first part of a 2017 interview with former Wren Mary Sherard. From 1942 until the end of the war, Mary served at Bletchley Park and then at the Eastcote Bomb Out Station. This all helped shape the rest of her life, because it was at Eastcote where she met her future husband, John. After originally servicing Spitfires in 1940, an interview at the Foreign Office sent John to Eastcote and Stanmore to maintain Mary's bomb machines. By the time of his demob from the RAF in 1946, he'd risen to the rank of warrant officer and married his Scots girl. In this second part of the interview, Mary talks to oral history volunteer Mike Chapman about not only her time at GCNCS, but also shares John's story. We hear about the rest of the war and also their fascinatingly varied post-war lives.
So for the recording, your husband was...
John.
John. So we've got him on the roll of honour as John Alfred
Sherard. Yes.
Right. Can you remember when he was recruited into the RAF?
It was very near the start of the war.
Right.
Because he was 2 years older than me and he would be 18 or so. He had left school, considered university career because he wanted to go into the church. But the political situation was not good and his family were real Cockney people, although they lived down in Leonsea by that time. His family did not think that university was the thing for him. So he got a job with London Midland Scottish LMS Railway in the Estate Department. But very quickly, war broke out and he joined up.
Right.
And then he was sent to an airfield to serve as Spitfires. And round about 1943 or so, he was summoned, I think, to the War Office and invited or sent to Bletchley Park. And he spent a week learning about the bomb and being taught about how to maintain it and how it operated. And then John was sent to Eastcote.
Right. Mm-hmm. And you say his rank was flight sergeant?
Flight sergeant.
Right. So he was in charge of a team, presumably?
Yes. The person in charge of all the RAF at Eastcote was pilot officer Jeff Taylor. And then I think it was John. And I think, you know, Jeff would be the person who ran the whole show for these men in the RAF, the work they did. But John was the sort of first practical boss. Do you
right.
see what I mean?
Yes. Yeah.
I met him very romantically behind a bomb at midnight because I was a leading Wren by this time at Eastcote, and I would sort of supervise the work of a bay. One of the bombs was proving difficult to get going, and we needed it, and none of the RAF boys who were on duty could get it going. And I said, well, you'll have to get John. And they said, no, he's had 72 hours without sleep. There's been so much happening. And they said, well, you can wake him up then. We're not. He needs his sleep.
Yeah.
And so I woke him up, and that was our our meeting. And he loved his work.
Right. This RAF team, did they work the same, I'm going to say watches, because you were Navy,
but yes.
for them it would have been shifts. Was it a similar arrangement?
Yes, yeah.
Right. So were they allocated to a building, a bay? How did that work? Can you remember?
You know, it was something like one RAF boy to each bay, I think.
Right.
You know.
And how many machines would be on a bay?
It was very much like Hut 11A, you know, there were 8 to 10 maybe or something
right.
like that.
Right.
I think John's notes are more full than mine right. on this particular subject. See if you think this is of interest. This is from John. In the many books which I have read about the Enigma, I have never discovered one in which credit is given to the one thing which made it possible, a 1-inch 0.19 strand brush, but I suppose it would be better to begin at the beginning. In 1940, I trained as an electrician in the RAF in Hereford, before being posted to RAF station Hortonchurch. After some months spent servicing the Spitfires, I was sent for an interview in an office in the Foreign Ministry. I was asked whether I got on well with women, well enough to work with them, and if I were prepared to work in a situation where there would be no promotion and I would not be able to tell folk what I was about. I think it was 4 weeks later I was called to report to Bletchley Park, from whence I was sent with some dozen others to Letchworth BTM Works, where we were given a week's training on the machines we were to service. These were the so-called bombs, operated by Wrens, but looked after and faults corrected by RAF. We were told that the Wrens were chosen for their intelligence, the RAF because of their electrical knowledge. And he always added, and because of their knowledge of women. From thence I was sent to Eastcote, a specially built outstation just being brought into operation. There was accommodation for some 200 Wrens and 50 RAF, housed, of course, in separate quarters and cut off from one another by a high wall. The Wrens worked on a four-watch system. The work station consisted of 8 bays, each containing 10 machines, a checkers room, a room for the mechanics, and a room containing the mercury arc transformer. One of the bays was set aside for the post office engineers operating a decoding machine, working on different principles. A central bay contained the offices, the teleprinter room, and, for the want of a better word, the menu room, where the information received from the teleprinter was turned into menus for the machines given to the operators. Each operational bay was named after a Commonwealth country, the machines after a city in that country. Each machine used 21 miles of wire, 3 banks of 30 drums, each drum containing 104 brushes containing 19 strands. Those rotated 50 times a minute on Bakelite commutators containing 4 rows of brass inserts. And inside the machine was an electric motor which drove the necessary mechanism. Inside the back gate were the rows of relays, each with 8 points and with porcelain resistors for each relay. The outside of the gate provided the necessary equipment for plugging up the menus. Be patient. I hope all will become clear. The outer gate consisted of 6 upright bars arranged in pairs. At the top of the first of a pair was the insert socket. This supplied the current in the decided position for searching the menu. The socket consisted of 26 contacts. The remaining spaces on the bars were filled with the sockets from each of the 10 rows of operating drums, the first socket supplying the power in the other by means of 2 26 brass contact plugs, each plug joined by some 3 feet of carefully plated wires. You can, I hope, begin to realise the number of soldered joints and possibility of errors each machine contained. One last thing, and then perhaps all might be made clearer by diagrams. On the side of the machine were 3 vertical rows of 26 switches, one for each letter of the alphabet, and these were for choosing which letter should be used for searching the menu. Above the switches were placed a row of levers. If, during a search, a possible answer were found, the appropriate lever would fall. I almost forgot, at the other end of the machine were the Unkervalse. This was the turnaround for the search and never changed. So complicated.
Absolutely.
And my husband wrote that in 1999. And he was discharged from the RAF and from his job
right.
in 1946.
Right. Crikey.
And he said to me, till the day he died, he could have set up a bomb. You
wow.
know? And he did this for one of his grandchildren, you know, this fantastic. Sort of stuff. My grandson has far more than I've got. I just came across this.
Right.
And I don't know whether it's accurate or not, because I don't know all these intricacies.
I'm not an expert on the bomb, but it sounds right to me.
Does it?
Yeah.
He was very confident about it. And as I say, I don't know whether we smuggled them or not, but we had all sorts of bits and pieces from the bomb when we were both right. demobbed. The wires and the Bakelite stuff. And we turned them into presents for people, you know. What do you call it? Napkin holders. But you see, we never discussed it. This is why I'm amazed at the detail he can go into. Because from the day he was demobbed, we never, ever discussed it. You know?
Incredible.
And
Absolutely incredible.
He could have gone on, but he had no wish to go on. Some of his pals went on, you know, because it was the start, really, of computers, wasn't it? And Jeff Taylor, the pilot officer in charge of everything at Eastcote, was our best man at our wedding.
Right.
And interestingly enough, you see, the way we were set up to live at Eastcote, we had the Wren's quarters. We also then had our camouflaged work block. And of course, the Wren's quarters were so different. They were purpose-built, nothing right. like my lovely Gayhurst Manor.
Yes.
And then beyond the camouflaged work building, there was the RAF quarters where they right. stayed. And attached to that, there was a flat. And pilot officer Jeff Taylor, his wife and child, had that flat. So I spent a lot of time through getting to know John in Jeff's flat. And that introduced me to not learning a lot more about the job, because that was never discussed. We only discussed that in the workplace.
Yeah.
That was something that we had to say to the GIs, because the GIs would come over after a bit to Eastcote, and they would work with us in the workplace, and we would tell them how we did this and how we did that. And then at night, in our quarters, they would come as our guests, and we would dance with them, the tortoise to jive and jitterbug, and we'd great fun with them. And they would continue their conversations about the bombs. And we would say, we can't talk about it. Of course you can. We're the same people.
Yeah.
And we said, we only talk about it in the workplace. That is ridiculous, they said.
Tell me a bit more about the GIs. What were they at Eastcote for?
We were told, as I remember it, that they were coming to Eastcote to learn of our work. And they didn't know anything about it, so they would come and work with us on watch. And I remember how difficult it was to get them to restrict their questions to us being on duty with them.
Yeah.
Because, as we say, they would teach us to jive. They would just, they brought us chocolates and they brought us nylon stockings and they spoiled us rotten, and we had great fun with them. But they could not understand why, when we were in the mess dancing to the gramophone, that they couldn't continue their conversations with us about our work. We only talk about that in the workplace, we said, and that's what we stuck to.
Did they actually do any of the work, or were they just there to learn?
Well, now, from what I've read, I believe that they began to do some work. The people that I came in contact with purely watched and asked questions and learned.
Right.
I don't think they ever worked really at Eastcote independently. I think they maybe tagged along and watched and helped.
Right.
And, you know, I had a trip to America in the year 2000, because I've been over to America once or twice, and I was introduced to, what do you call the secret police in America?
CIA.
And I met two young men, and they said, why the heck didn't you talk about it, you know, to all these GIs that we sent over? And I said, we did, but in the workplace, what's the difference?
Yeah.
They couldn't see it at all. And I was grilled by them, because, I mean, the year 2000, I was quite elderly then, and they were young, but by Jove, did they quiz me about Bletchley Park. Interesting.
Mm.
I think I must shut up.
Do you want a little break?
No, not necessarily.
I'm absolutely fascinated. So,
am I being boring?
Because No, you are definitely. Mary, you are doing brilliantly.
Because
this is fantastic.
But you can see why John could have given you... Well, maybe you don't need all these intricacies.
No. As you said before we started this recording, it's people's memories. That's what's important.
Can I just give you a funny story?
Please.
Can I give you a funny story to get away from all that? Because I was a leading wren for 4 months, and then I became a petty officer. But while I was still a leading wren, I was on duty the night that the wren's cabin for Bee Watch was hit by incendiaries. Because maybe I haven't said this. In fact, I definitely haven't said this to you. Life was very, very different at Eastcote as a wren because we were treated now as service girls. We had to do parade work. What do you call it? Squad drill.
Right.
We had to raise and lower the flag every day. We had to go to church parade in our off-duty time. We definitely were in the services. And I remember all that very, very clearly because it was such a shock to us after living at Gayhurst to have this regimented life. Mind you, we'd lots and lots of fun. But the incendiaries fell the whole time that we were there. We were living in London now. And so when we came off duty, we always had to take at least an hour, sometimes more, standing outside our cabin door with a stirrup pump, putting out the incendiaries as they came down. And I remember, you know, falling asleep one night because you were tired after you'd come off duty. And, you know, you'd wake up and... And I covered the inspecting officer in foam, you know. And then I remember, but the really funny story was that one night our cabin, and I was a leading wren, so I had a wee room with 3 or 4 other leading wrens off it. But the big cabin was for 60 wrens and incendiaries set it alight. Crikey. And my job as a leading wren was to get them out, the girls. But they looked out the window, all these 60 wrens, and they saw the RAF coming to rescue them because the whole place was ablaze. And these wonderful wren friends of mine, they got their makeup out and they changed their pyjamas and then they opened the windows and jumped into the arms of the RAF. And we were so fortunate because the 2 bunks that got the direct incendiary were burnt, of course, to a cinder. But the girls were on annual leave. That was really amazing. I can remember this leisurely way they just got their makeup. I can remember them jumping into the arms of the RAF. But we had to get workmen in to put the place back as soon as possible. And we had no place to sleep, but we still had to work. You could usually find the bed or the bunk of a watch that was on standby, you know. So we'd all these kind of experiences. And I can remember my frustration. Well, these girls get out of their bunks and, you know.
Yeah.
But it was very different life at Eastcote. And, of course, lots and lots more people. But, you see, my recollections are just my recollections, you know.
They're still fascinating. Mm-hmm. Very, very interesting. Changing subject slightly. So you went from a wren to a leading wren, and then you went to a PO. Presumably, all of those promotions, you got extra money. Do you remember how much you were paid?
No, I can't.
You can't?
I can't remember anything about it.
Right.
What I remember is wrens didn't get underwear issued. ATS and WAF got everything issued. We did not. We got chits to take into shops so that we could choose our own underwear, which was wonderful.
Oh, yeah.
Because some shops, of course, would be very accommodating and give you different stuff. I remember that very clearly indeed. What got me onto that?
We were talking about uniform. We were talking about the difference between a normal wren, a leading wren, and a PO. If we were talking about uniform allowance and that sort of thing, did you get different rates?
The only thing I remember as being different in any of it was the petty officer's hat, which was a tricorn.
All right.
Because we had our wee sailor hat for wren and leading wren, and then that's why my husband sent me that thing. Hope the hat fits.
Oh.
It was a tricorn, and I hated giving up my little sailor cap for the tricorn. And we had a petty officer's mess in Eastcote with very few petty officers. I remember when I went in for the first time being greeted by a petty officer I didn't know at all. And she knew I'd just been married, I think. And she said, "Can I see your ring?" "Don't ever take it off," she said. I took mine off and his plane came down the next day. Okay. So there was all these kind of things around. You see, by that time, I had John as a boyfriend, and so any spare time I had was spent with him rather than in the petty officer's mess. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah. So was he with you at Eastcote all that time?
Or? No, he was at Eastcote until we married, and that was in January 1945. So then he was sent to Stanmore, and he was promoted. He sort of got a job parallel to Pilot Officer Jeff Taylor at right. Eastcote at Stanmore, and he was made a warrant officer. So he was there from 1945 right through to 1946, October. And why I'm so sure of this is that we didn't know that I was going to be pregnant. Right. And so when he was sent to Stanmore and I was at Eastcote and the war was drawing to a close, we knew that it was a happy time. He said to me, I shall be kept on for at least a year, you know, to clear up everything. Mm. And he said, so I'll be given a little flat just as Jeff has here at Eastcote. And I've been told to get you to help me choose some furniture for it. That's why I know my memory is correct, because so much happened at that time that I would doubt some of my memory things. But I remember he said, you know, we'll have a sort of little flatlet when the war is over and I continue and you'll be demobbed because you're my wife. You'll be able to come and live with me.
Right.
And so we have to plan how we're going to furnish this little flat.
We've got a bit in the middle though, haven't we? So you met when you needed the bomb machine repairing. That was the first time that you met.
Yeah.
You went and woke him up because he'd been working for 72 hours. We've talked about you getting married in January 1945. Mm. There's a bit in the middle. How you got engaged. What's the story behind that?
We must have met very quickly after I moved to Eastcote. And that was when it was set up.
Yeah.
Both John and I think, were in at the beginning of Eastcote.
Right.
So I got to know him then just through fun and teasing and all the rest of it. He told me how he'd looked out for all the Scottish wrens and, you know, blah, 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 and settled on me kind of stuff. Now, that was in September 43. By January 44, we were definitely a couple and went to all sorts of things together. But 1944, as you'll know, was the beginning of the run-up to D-Day. 6 months, we had no leave at all.
Right.
And my 21st birthday came in that period. And I know now that there was betting amongst these Wren officer friends that I'd come back with an engagement ring on my birthday, 22nd of April. With no leave, you see.
Mm.
But John, of course, worked more or less days because that was his kind of different role. And he was at Eastcote, so I saw a lot of him. And I was on night watch. So that was the second time that I didn't go to my bed. Do you see what I mean?
Yes.
I did my night watch and then I had a day in London with John and I met his parents. His mother said to him in my hearing, you're marrying a Scots girl? A French girl I could understand, but a Scots girl. That day, John would not announce our engagement because I didn't have a ring and we didn't have time to go and get one.
Right.
So we didn't announce our engagement. And then on D-Day, when things eased off dramatically, I was surprised when John suggested we go up to London. But D-Day was so exciting. We'd waited for it for such a long time. We're not needed now. We've got a day off. We shall go to London and we'll buy a ring. And I know a little place in the East End of London where we can get a lovely ring. His father had an upholstery business in the East End of London. So that was a big adventure, going by tube to the East End. And we were stopped by the military police. London was deserted. I thought there'd be a buzz. It was absolutely deserted. And this military police, and I've told you the story of how John wasn't the least bit worried about it. He just brought out this card and showed it to them. And they just said, okay, okay, sir, not to be questioned.
Yes.
And John said, bring out yours. I don't have one. You do, you're a petty officer, for heaven's sake. I said, well, I do not have one. And these military police standing looking at us, you know, arguing. And John said, oh, she's just a bit stupid, you know. And I remember they just laughed and let it go. But I remember being slightly taken aback at that. We shouldn't really be there, or should we? We went into this wee shop and we bought a ring, and I wore my ring, and we went back. And, of course, it was a good thing to have done, because we didn't have many days free for a wee while. Because, you know, at D-Day, you were still working quite hard. But those were exciting days in our job.
Yes. January, you got married.
You see, that was the first time we could get leave together.
Right.
And we had a week's leave.
Right. And you had some of your work colleagues there, presumably. Some of the Wrens and some of the Aria.
I had Jean Wright, you know, my pal that I'd had to leave behind, because she did not go to Eastcote.
Yeah.
But she was able to come. And Jeff Taylor came. And there was a Jock Bishop who was our chief usher. And, of course, as you probably know, weddings were restricted. You could only have 50, not more than that. And
I didn't know that.
My mother and father wanted to give me a real old... I was only 21. John was only 23. A real good old time. And I was married in a church just across the road from our flat. That was the only thing my father said he didn't agree with. You know, he had to get a taxi to take me across the Great Western Road in Glasgow. We were married in church. And then we had a reception for 50 people in a little tiny hotel along the way. And John and I had fixed up to have 6 nights or something in Ilkley Moor on our way south.
Right.
We had to report back in 7 days. And we spent the first night at Skipton because there was no real timetable. My father knew that there was going to be a train out of Glasgow Queen Street Station about 6 o'clock at night, the day we were married, the 6th of January, and he got his bank messenger to queue up from 8 in the morning for a seat on that train.
Oh.
And that fellow did that. And when we got there at 6, having left the hotel where we had the reception, to get the train to Skipton, which was then going to allow us to take a bus to Ilkley, we had seats on the train. It was packed, packed. But, of course, I made the mistake of opening a case to get out some sandwiches, and there was confetti everywhere. It was a real RAF wedding, I can tell you. But we got to Skipton about 9:30 at night, and we stayed in a hotel opposite the station. And the next day, we took a bus to Ilkley. Now, my father was the only one in the secret, and he promised faithfully he would tell nobody. But he had a little quartet playing music at our reception while we had our meal, and they played on Ilkley Moor Batat every second piece, so everybody knew where we were going. And the reason I remember all of this is that just a fortnight ago, my son, whom you met, and his wife have a canal boat very near Skipton, and they knew I'd never seen it. That's another long story. And so a fortnight ago, they took me down, and I stayed. And Dane had discovered the hotel that John and I had spent the first night of our honeymoon in, and he booked me in there. And I stayed there because I couldn't stay on the narrow road. And that was just a fortnight ago, so I'm still a bit high on it, you know. It was right on the canal. My daughter came with me and her husband, and the hotel's changed its name, Midlands Hotel, and it's now the Heriot's Hotel. But those were all wartime experiences. I remember we got there 9:30 at night, and a lovely little maid gave us supper. And then the next day we set off and went to Ilkley.
Right.
And we had 6 days there, and then we went down south. We went back.
So he went to Stanmore and you went to Eastcote.
That was the first time he'd gone to Stanmore, I think.
Was it?
I think so. Yeah, because it was 1945 when we married. But he was there all 45, 46.
Just out of interest, had they deliberately separated the two of you?
Yes,
because
I think so.
Right.
Yes. I believe so. Also, they made it clear to John, they were quite considerate, you know, that he could have a little flat once the war was over and I could go and live there. But as I think I've said to you, I was pregnant by that time, and my father-in-law, who was a real cockney and a great businessman, he had an upholstery business, had a woman in Tufnell Park do him a favour, and she owned a big property and she had a flat, and John was allowed to live out once the war was over. So he lived at home, and we lived in Tufnell Park for a year at the end of the war. And this was where we were crazy, because he was a warrant officer, good money, and he got a very, very generous living out allowance.
Yeah.
And this flat, I mean, nobody would want it nowadays, but we thought it was heaven. It was at the very top of a house, and it had a bedroom and a sitting room, a cupboard of a kitchen, no water, and a bathroom that didn't have a toilet, just a bath and a washhand basin. And we had to use the toilet of the flat downstairs, and they had to use our bath. Right. But you see, we didn't think that mattered.
No.
They were an ex-service couple.
Yeah.
And we had a happy, happy year there.
Yeah.
We should have been saving like mad because of the money we were getting.
Yeah.
And we didn't.
No.
We went to the theatre, we went mad. And and we had parties for the RAF, we had parties for the Wrens. I suppose it was after the war.
Yeah.
It was great.
So talking of which, you got married. John went to Stanmore, you went to Eastcote. May 1945, German surrender. VE Day. What do you remember about that?
Oh, a lot. Right. That was a big day for me. John, of course, was at Stanmore and I was at Eastcote. And he got in touch with me and we went up. We stood outside Buckingham Palace. We did all the things that people did and watched the royals come out onto the balcony. And I remember people playing around in the fountains, you know. You were carried along by the flow. And then John insisted I went home and stayed at Stanmore overnight. And that absolutely horrified me, but I did it and went back to Eastcote the next morning. Petty officer and all as I was, a fear of trembling that I'd be carpeted for, you know, nobody cared a hoot. The war was over and we were just all, you know. So
you stayed in his quarters at Stanmore?
For a night.
For a night.
Mm-hmm. And I hid under the blankets when his orderly came in with his tea. I really was horrified. I went and got pyjamas from Nancy, my pal.
Right.
And it was crazy, crazy. But for my wedding, may I just say this? You don't know Lucy Adlington. She's a costume historian.
I don't.
Very well known in the north of England. Right. I met her at the Berwick 900 stuff. And she asked me stupid questions. What did you wear when you were relaxing in the Wrens? I said, we wore our uniform. No, when you were going to a dance, you would. I said, see, we had no place to hang clothes or anything. You wore your uniform all the time. I said, of course. I wore my uniform all the time. When we got engaged, and John was wondering if his warrant officer uniform would be through for the wedding, I just knew that I must get my uniform clean so that it was nice because I'd have to be married in uniform. And one of these lovely Wrens that had been an ex-deb and I had met when we were in the early days at Gayhurst Manor said to me, Mary, would you like to borrow one of my ex-deb gowns to be married in? Oh, couldn't believe it. And she produced this ivory satin gown.
Right.
Long tapering sleeves. You know, quite a demure thing.
Yeah, yeah.
Lovely to be married in, up to the neck.
Right.
And it meant I could wear then my granny's orange blossom in my hair. And so I said, wonderful.
Yeah.
She said, don't cut it, but take it. And you can have it pinned or sewn to fit you properly. I got a dressmaker. So was that not kind?
I'm very kind.
And I had that in Glasgow. So John was in his flight sergeant's uniform at Wars. He hadn't got his warrant officer thing through. But I was in my lovely gown.
Right.
And when I tell that story, as I do to teenagers, because I'm sometimes invited to talk to them, they say, you wore somebody else's dress to be married in. I said, of course I did. And I was so, we would never, ever do that, ever. And you think, you haven't a clue, have you?
No.
You know?
There was a war on.
And after that, that dress was passed round every bride that was coming up.
Right.
And I gather that by the end, about 40 people were married in that dress. But wasn't that kind of
her? Very, very kind. Fantastic.
They were nice girls, you know.
Yeah.
And nobody had to know and didn't know that it wasn't mine.
So VE Day, war in Europe, did the work carry on or did it change from that point?
It stopped on VE Day just like that.
Right.
Because there would be a section, the Japanese section, that would continue. But my memory is that the work just stopped. I couldn't believe it when peace was declared.
Yeah. So what did you do?
That was in the May. I was at Eastcote and I don't remember being asked to do any clearing up at all. I must have been pregnant by that time, perhaps. And I just remember they took us on trips. It was almost as if they were entertaining us till they could demob us.
Right.
But then I hear of people like Irene, who was sent to Germany for a year living in Berlin as an undercover agent. And I realised that quite a few of my colleagues got those kind of secret jobs to do, particularly if their German was good. But that changed the course of her life, really. It wasn't a happy time for her at all.
Irene, what was her surname?
King.
Right, she'd been working on the bombs as well.
Yeah, I mean, she never got any promotion there at all because I'd been at school with her and she went and did a course of French and German at Glasgow University. And then in the big splurge of 1943, she was called up. And by that time, any jobs that had any kind of tiny bit of promotion, people like me got, because we'd worked there rather than going studying.
Was she at Eastcote with you?
Yes.
The other name you give me, which I realise I should have asked the same question, the lady who sorted you out with pyjamas at Stanmore.
Nancy Burke. Nancy was a great school friend of mine in Glasgow. And so was Irene. We all went to the Glasgow High School for Girls. And Nancy was separated from me because I joined up as soon as I could.
Right.
She did something else first. She was maybe younger than me. So, you know, she had to wait till she was old enough. But she was much earlier at Stanmore than John. She would maybe go to Stanmore when I went to Eastcote.
And your friend Jean Wright, did she stay at Bletchley or did she move as well?
She stayed at Bletchley. Unfortunately and sadly, she developed TB and so she was sent to a sanatorium. And Jean was a clever, clever girl from a much wealthier family than mine, but very like mine.
Mm.
And I'm glad to say that the TB didn't develop or show itself until after our wedding. She was able to come to our wedding. Right. But she just didn't have terribly good health, you see.
Right.
And then she had a year in a sanatorium. And she has died now, but she did have quite a good life.
When were you demobbed?
Well, October was the date of my papers. But September, I think, was when I actually left. And fairly quickly, my father-in-law got us this flat. So we were able to go and have 6 months in that flat before the baby was born. And then I went out to Watford to have the baby out there because it was the baby boom time, babies everywhere.
And that's
Dane. I'd kept the receipts for all that stuff because, you see, that was before NHS.
Right.
It cost about £12 for a fortnight in this nursing home and it cost about 7 guineas for the doctor's fee. I remember that. But I also remember the hotel that we stayed in at Skipton for one night, bed and breakfast, early morning tea and lunch was £2 for the two of us.
Right.
You know,
yes,
crazy.
Yeah. So John carried on at Stanmore. Tell me again, what was he doing at Stanmore after the war?
Getting rid of everything. I think he was in overall charge of that for Stanmore and maybe even for others, for Eastcote, you know.
Right.
But he lived out because they gave him that option. And he worked 8 in the morning till 6 at night kind of thing. He was able to be home every night.
Yeah.
And Tufnell Park, that's North Severn in London. It wasn't too far for him to travel.
And he was demobbed when?
October 46.
What did he then go off to do after the war?
The LMS, the State Department, had kept his job open and had paid him a little all through the war. And so when he was offered all these wonderful jobs with some of the computer-to-be firms, he just said, no, I'm going back to LMS. And he did, and they sent us to Leeds. We had a year there, and he was studying for the Estate Department exams. And he got another promotion, and we were sent to Crewe. And he had a tremendous job in Crewe in the LMS railway. And he was just going soaring up promotion-wise. And British Rail came into being. He got an interview and he was told that he had been promoted far beyond what he should have been for his age. British Rail said for 10 years there'll be no more promotion. So he packed it in and he took a job with the, dearie me, it's the American company up in NCR, National Cash Register Company.
Right.
And he got an interview, was given the job and he was sent up to Dundee and we found a flat. They had 2 children by that time.
Right.
And he enjoyed it tremendously. That was in 1951 or something like that. And I remember my father came up and helped us find a flat and we moved in. And then we found a house that we liked in Broughty Ferry. And with this lovely house that we'd bought, which was quite a big house, 8 roomed or something, and we were doing it up gradually. And we had 2 children and were expecting another one, who sadly died. But that was, you know how every family has it. We had a bad period of losing family members, and we lost this baby. I remember the consultant said to me, "You've got two lovely children, be content." And my doctor said, "Don't end on a failure." So we had another baby, and he was fine, and he lives nearby. And then John had wanted, you know, when he was about 17, 18, to go into the church. We became very much church members. He was helping all sorts of things. There was also the Billy Graham campaign, and I think that had something to do with it. He was going to go into the church. That was his real love.
Yes.
And all his wartime experience, everything. I was surprised at it, but it was obviously a calling. And he had to then pay for 5 years university, St Andrews, of course, because we were up in Scotland. Yeah. And we got no help with that, which he would have got if he'd done it straight from the RAF.
Yes.
But we didn't. So it was a struggle. But the very day we decided, no, this is what we have to do, and I'll jolly well find some way of working. This sounds crazy. There was a ring at the doorbell, and here was this black man, Mauritian, Hassam. And he said to me, "I understand you might..." This is 1955, 56.
Right.
"I understand you've got a big house here, and you might consider giving me accommodation. I have married a white girl. She's a nurse. I'm training to be a doctor." We got the full story later. His father was very, very wealthy, had sent him over to train as a doctor in Dundee in the Maryfield Hospital. And he'd fallen in love with Hannah, who was an Irish nurse, and they married, and his father cut him off. And so he was left to find his own way of getting his fees and to live with Hannah. And Hannah had to support them through her nursing money. And they couldn't find anyone who would take a black man and a white woman. Because you see, that's 1956.
Yes.
The world has moved on. He said, "But I have been told that you and your husband are really kind people.
Yeah.
Would you give us a room, just a bed?" I said, "You're an answer to prayer." Oh, he says, "I'm a Muslim." I said, "Well, it doesn't matter. You're an answer to prayer. Come in. Tell me about it." And then I met Hannah, who was a Catholic. And they stayed with us for the 5 years that John was a student. And that set me off into realizing I could make money out of the house. Everything just came together. My school friend married a fellow who was the first geriatric consultant in Scotland. And he said to me, "Mary, we need nurses." And I didn't want to be a nurse. I applied for a job as journalist with DC Thompson because I'd had a job as a reporter when I was waiting to join up. And DC Thompson wouldn't employ me in Dundee because I was a married woman. They'd take anything freelance, you know. So I couldn't do that. So I'd nursed, and the matron was so good. I worked antisocial hours so that that suited John was there. Yeah. And then I was asked if I would take three of the old folk who were too poor to go to a nursing home but still needed attention. And so they came and lived with me. Now, you see, that wouldn't be done nowadays. So we had 5 years of adventures making money. Scott, who was two when all this happened to his dad, used to go out onto the pavement and say, "Have you got anywhere to sleep tonight? My mum will give you a bed." John was 35 when he went to study at St Andrews University, and then he was 40 when he was ordained. He had four different charges, one in Newtyle, that's a little village in Angus, one in Dundee, which was church extension, working with poor folk. Then he'd one on Gala Shields in the Borders, and then he had one in Glams, where this Glaswegian and this Cockney married, and we were now mixing with the royals because, you know, that was the Queen Mother's residence.
Oh, right.
And of course, so every weekend we had the Queen Mother up. It was just a completely different way of life. But John, this Cockney lad who did all these experiences, was the favourite of them all, rather than the titled folk, because he just liked them or didn't like them as people. Lady Kayser was the first place, Newtyle. They were aristocrats, but they were moneyed aristocrats. Mm. And her son was 21, and he came to call on us when we got there. "I've come at the nursery hour, Mrs. Sherrard, because that's the hour you'll be spending with the children, you know, and this sort of thing." And I remember Dane by this time was about 15, and he said to Dane, "You know, you may walk on my hills any time you wish, And Dane said to him, "And you may walk Sir James in my garden any time you wish." And I thought, "You cheeky boy." But that did us no harm at all. Yeah. A different way of doing things. What adventures we've had.
Yeah.
I mustn't go into all of this because I've given me adventures. I became chairman of the Scottish Preschool Play Association and I became Scottish Citizens Advice Bureau. Different charges we went to, there were different openings and I got different training. I was the first woman lay member of the Law Society of Scotland's Complaints Committee and that was exciting. I've been given lots of opportunities.
Right.
As you know, I didn't go to university, but my three children did. And so when my youngest was at university and we were in Galashiels, I had planned to go to a university in Dundee when John was there. He was called from Dundee to Galashiels just as I'd got it set up, the course at Dundee University. And I remember he said to me, "Well, you can come and see me at weekends." However, I didn't do that. So I became, I think they called us an A student, which purely meant you were the first year of the Open University.
Oh,
and
right.
I got an Open University degree when I was about 55 or something. And Scott was studying history at Cambridge, and I was studying it at the Open University. And I thought, my teaching is far better than you're getting. So I got a degree there. But that was a tremendous experience to do that.
So you've done all these things. You've been members. You've been chairman. Did you have any recognition?
I did. And strangely enough, I hadn't thought to put that in my story until today. I got an MBE in 1977, the New Year Honours List. Yeah. It would be 1978, I think. And I got an MBE granted. Such a surprise. John knew about it and I didn't. It was granted for service to the community. Scottish Preschool Playgroups have put my name forward. So had Borders Regional Council, and they paid all my travel down to Buckingham Palace in 1978, and that was a thrill.
Yes.
I'm the kind of person that enjoys that.
Yeah. Who the Queen. Presentation? The Queen?
The Queen, yeah.
Right.
I was allowed two people, so I took John and my mother, and my mother just loved the whole thing, but so did we all. Strangely enough, I've been to Buckingham Palace comparatively recently with my daughter, who's got the MBE.
Oh, she has as well.
Mm-hmm. And it was so different because I got mine in 78. She got hers 2009. And she was allocated three spaces, three people she could take. So she said she would take me and she would take her son and she'd take her husband. And I said, "Olive, you've got to take Dev. That's my grandson's girlfriend," as she was then. And they're now expecting a baby. Yeah. I said, "You've got to take Dev. Dev's from California. To her, it'll just be wonderful to go."
Yeah.
And she said, "No," but I said, "Yes, I've been, Olive. I'll come down with you and join in the fun." So she wrote to Buckingham Palace or she emailed them or something.
Yeah.
So she gave the names and she said, "It should have been my mum, but my mum's given her place up." And they emailed her back and they said, "Your mum's been here. Tell her to come again." So they let me go as well. What
fantastic.
A time we had. And she
Absolutely.
Had Prince Charles.
There's one area that we haven't covered. You and John have been working together and then working separately, World War II. After the war, did the two of you talk about what you'd done working to help break Enigma?
Never.
Never?
Not even with each other.
Right.
It never, ever occurred to us to say anything about it. It had been instilled in us that you talked about it only in the workplace.
Right. Did that change?
Suddenly in 1974, that was the end of the 30 years from the Official Secrets Act, and there was something in the paper around about that time, newspaper. We hardly noticed it or mentioned it. And then books began appearing, and we would read the books. But nobody quizzed us or questioned us. We didn't really think about it at all. We had busy, busy lives.
Yes.
And I was immersed at that time in 1974, 75, in both playgroups and Citizens Advice Bureau. John was in his third charge at Galashiels, where he was for 13 years, loving what he was doing. And then 1989-90, John retired after 30 years as an ordained minister. And we went to live in Buckhaven, where my son was minister and was very much involved in a lot of the youth employment schemes that the government had and all sorts of things. That's Dane's kind of forte. And John was able to help him unofficially, you know, with that. And that's how we lived.
Yes.
Now, you see, I think John did as much good in those retirement years. Yeah. And he did that right up till 1999 when he died. And then I was thrown on my own. So in the 1990s, when he was doing all this, I don't know what it was, whether it made him think of the days of Bletchley Park. He began talking of his experiences at Bletchley Park and maybe even using it to help some of the people who were... Do you know
what
I mean?
That makes sense. No, I know absolutely what you mean, yeah.
And then Dane took a hand in it because he had a church by this time and they had a group there. And Dane said to his dad, I want you to come through and tell them the story of Bletchley Park. And John, to my surprise, because his son had asked him, agreed to do it. And that's when he sat down and wrote up all sorts of stuff, did diagrams, and then took me, and he did the first part, and I did the second part, and it was well received, and we began to get invitations, and we accepted them, but John didn't live very long after that. And when he died, 6 months after he died, they had a memorial service for him in Buckhaven. And a lot of people from all over Scotland, because we'd travelled a lot in the church, came. And I was invited to go back to Glam's for a party. And when I got to the party in November of 1999, the hostess, a farmer's wife, said to me, there's a paper and pencil. Sit down and write about your experiences at Bletchley, because we've heard that you have given this before John died. And we never got John to come and tell us. And the Countess is coming, the Countess of Airlie, the Countess of is coming tonight, you know, the people that you knew up here. And I said, I can't do that. She said, of course you can. Just sit down. And she said, just a few of us are gathering together tonight. And when I got, they had a huge, huge meeting. Right. And why I'm telling you that is that then that made all the invitations come to me.
Right.
And that's why I set off. Since 1999, I've done about 150 talks.
Fantastic.
Which have changed a bit with time. I don't know whether my talk is accurate or not, but I don't think it's wildly inaccurate. You've heard bits of it.
I think it's pretty good. Mary, that was absolutely fantastic. I feel we should stop.
I apologise if I've been too long.
No. You have been absolutely fantastic.
Thanks to the paid and volunteer staff, visitors and veterans who took part in this podcast. To find out more, go to bletchleypark.org.uk. You can follow Bletchley Park on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram. This podcast is produced for the Bletchley Park Trust by MC Fontaine and supported by Audioboom. If you like this podcast, please leave us a review on iTunes. Thanks for listening, and we'll have more decrypts from the home of the Codebreakers next month.